Join me, Paul Ash, in a beautiful soundscape as we explore the world in the Sunday Times Travel Podcast. Find it at sundaytimes.co.za. You're listening to the Sunday Times Travel Podcast, and I'm Paul Ash. I'm sitting here with a man called Rusty Labuskagne. He's a Zimbabwean, a former hunter, a pilot, a public speaker. I've got him here today to talk about his book, which has been recently published. It's called Beating Chains. And the key thing about this book is it's an exploration of injustice and how to overcome it. I'm going to give you the short version. Rusty did 10 years in a Zimbabwean prison for a murder that didn't happen, that he didn't commit. Rusty, good morning. Welcome
morning,
to the show.
Paul.
How are you doing?
Very good. Good to be here. Thanks.
Lekker. We had a good trip up to Zimbabwe last week.
We did.
I was really impressed with your kind of, your attitude and your kind of love for that country, despite what, you know, what it did to you.
Yeah.
You know, just give us the short version of what happened in 2003.
Paul, I had a fishing resort on Lake Kariba, and there was a dispute between a fishing cooperative and myself. They were consumptive, netting fish, and situated about 1 kilometer along the shore away from the fish breeding ground where my camp was situated. And they were forever netting fish in the fish breeding area. And there was conflict in there where I would remove their nets. So I was antagonizing their well-being, really, but there's a lot of other places to catch fish. And then in December 2000, the land invasions started in Zim. And it appeared that the injustice started creeping in everywhere. And I chased two poachers in a steel boat that were setting nets in the fish breeding area. And as soon as they saw me with my co-accused coming towards them, they started paddling hastily for the shore in an effort to get away from us. Knowing they were known poachers, I drove my boat towards them to scare them off, and the wake of my boat tilted their boat, causing them to jump out into the water, which was about 1.5 meters deep. They were about 3 meters from the shore and soon scrambled to dry land. My friend and I then watched as they ran away into the bush, thinking nothing more of it. The following day, the police arrived and accused us of drowning one of those poachers.
Wow.
And then it got very political after that, Paul. You know, there were marches outside. Three days later, the police asked us on the day after when they arrived and accused us. They asked us when we're leaving. We said in 3 days' time. They asked us to report to the police station on our way back. It's a very, very remote area. So 70 k's away was the police station. We arrived there, we were detained immediately. Then 2 days later, transferred to Binga Police Station. And there, the tension was unbelievable. And there were marchers on the street with huge banners, 200 people, you know, whites killed black, the Matang. It became a very big political thing in all the newspapers around the country. And that's where it all started going wrong.
So you were kind of, not so much in the wrong place at the wrong time, but the incident happened at a time when tensions were unbearably strained.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing from the book that you got the court records, the court transcripts.
Yes.
And, you know, just looking at it, you could see that the police didn't have any evidence against you.
Nothing.
And it looks like a political fit-up.
It was, Paul. I mean, I think in history, around the world, only 6 people have been convicted of murder without a body.
Wow.
And in the trial, very little was produced to prove that somebody died. It was just, you know, he drowned and the crocodiles ate him, and that was it. Despite state witnesses stating that they've witnessed 18 people being taken by crocodiles, and there's always something you find. of the person, and they didn't buy any of it.
Yeah, because habeas corpus is a fundamental cornerstone of law.
Yeah.
You have a body.
Yeah.
If you don't have a body, then what? I know.
Well, you know, the law states you can't accuse someone of murder without first proving somebody died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's a horrifying story. And, you know, it begins with your night in Carmi Maximum. Tell me a bit about Carmi, because it sounds like from the book.
Yeah, Paul. You know, just to give you an idea, before I got in there, I had 5 safari camps, a fishing resort on Lake Kariba, flying my own aircraft. So I was doing very, very well, living the life. And then you go from an innocent man, full of confidence, everything going perfectly in his life, to being accused of murder. And my first evening in there, first of all, you arrive there in laying handcuffs and leg irons. When you leave the courthouse, it was on Main Street during rush hour, and everyone was watching. And I was a well-known figure. I was a national rugby player, so everybody knew who I was. So it was incredibly humiliating. Then you arrive at the prison, which is 25 k's out of town, and they take your document, you know, your particulars and everything, remove your handcuffs and leg irons. Then you have to strip naked and walk into the maximum security exercise yard stark naked. And there were 1,000 guys in there. I was the only white guy. It was unbelievably terrifying. I mean, sure. I always had this phobia about going to prison. You know, you see the guys working on the streets in the white uniforms, and here in South Africa, I think it's orange. And it just, you don't look at them because, you know, it's like they're a different part of society. Well, they're actually normal people, but when you go in there, it's bloody terrifying.
Well, it's a visceral fear, isn't it? Being locked up and incarcerated, especially for someone like you who is used to the endless horizons of the bush. But then, you know, to be basically caged is a fundamental human phobia.
Yeah.
I don't know any humans who...
No, it was terrifying, eh, Paul? Big time. But, you know, some of the things I learned in there, Paul, on the first evening. So we got in there, the cells were 13 meters long. Well, first of all, you crouched down in front of the officers, and there were 4 officers, and they bombarded me with questions about where I come from, my family, my crime, all kinds of things for about 15 minutes, naked, in front of 1,000 guys.
Wow.
So that was, you know, they try and break you right from the start. Then they escorted me, one of the prisoners escorted me up to my cell. And that was 13 meters long by 3 meters wide. We were 78 guys in there. Then each person had 33 centimeters of space marked out on the walls in chalk.
Okay, so 33 centimeters is 3 centimeters longer than your average school ruler.
Yeah.
So think about that, people. So think about 30 centimeters. That was Rusty's living space.
Sleeping space. It was a horrific ball because, first of all, it was not allowed to sleep on your back. But you couldn't fit anyway. You know, someone my size, if I lie on my side, I take up 33 centimeters. And then it's 3 meters wide. So your legs all cross over in the middle because, you know, everybody's over 1.5 meters tall. And there's no blankets and there's no bedding. There's no furniture whatsoever in a Zim prison. No beds, no tables, no chairs, no cupboards, nothing.
Yeah, you said after 6 years you got to sit on your first chair or something.
7.5 years, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so you wrap your clothes around your toothbrush and toothpaste, or that gets stolen, and that was your pillow. Then you had 3 blankets. So you fold 2 of them several times to fit your space as cushioning against the cold concrete floor, then covered yourself with the 3rd one. And your legs all cross over in the middle, and you all face the same direction, otherwise you breathe into each other. And when you turned over, it was all together. I mean, it was horrific.
And that was all night, going on all night.
And that was for many, many years. But
that's incredible. I mean, it's the conditions are horrific.
No, they were unbelievable. Something that I remember that night, Paul, that I love to share. So when I went to prison, I was running 5 of my own companies and just working like a machine. And when I got into the cell that night on the first evening, now I've been bitten by lice. I've never seen lice before. They bite you day and night. It is unbelievable. And you're squashed with all these people on the hard concrete floor. And I remember lying there and thinking, this is not too bad. They can do whatever they want. That pressure of the release of all that stuff I'd taken on over the years. And I think it's a big lesson for guys, for me especially. I swore that evening, I said, I will never, ever again take on so much in my life, because I was working for my businesses. You know, they weren't working for me, so they owned me. And I think there's a big lesson there. Where don't get yourself into something that's going to own you.
Yeah. See, that's another kind of prison, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just working all the time. You know, it's what, to be flippant, and you've done the real hard time. People call it a jail without a lock.
Yeah.
You know, but they're both prisons. One is physical and one is of the mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's horrific. How is it that Kami got to be such a bad place? One assumes that it wasn't built with the kind of horrific conditions in mind that were there when you were incarcerated.
Yeah, Paul, it was built in 1956. And, I mean, over the years, with it's a three-story building, and all the plumbing is on the outside of the building. So when you have your sewage pipes for all the toilets running down the side of the building, and when they get blocked, they were cast iron pipes. So sections were cut out of them with a cutting torch to remove the blockages. And then you can't weld that patch on again. So they wrap it with strips of blanket. And they would forever be festering with maggots. And I mean, it was the smell, Paul. And then that was when things were good. Then when it got bad and blockages came, then they just smashed the sewage pipes and they would leak. And there are 12 toilets in Kami Maximum Security Prison.
12?
12, yeah.
For how many prisoners?
For 1,000 prisoners. And they are on three different floors. So it's four on each floor. And the bottom floor, all the toilets never worked. So you had 8 toilets, and there were fiberglass toilets cemented into solid concrete blocks to squat over. But when you have blockages, you can't get to the pipes. So there was a hole, about a tennis ball size hole, smashed into the back of the toilet bowl, so the plumber's stainless steel rods could flow down into the pipes to unblock them. But that just meant that all the smell comes flowing out day and night.
Day and night.
So the whole place, Paul, stunk of excretion.
Well, this is, I mean, one assumes that the government or the prison authorities could have done something to fix this. But this now sounds like a calculated effort to degrade you, to degrade all the people in there. And it makes one think that there was no interest in reforming people.
No.
Prison was just revenge.
It was punishment, Paul. Purely a punishment. You know, when you go in there, and they tell you in there, when you go in and you're full of confidence, flying high, bulletproof, they crush you. They crush your confidence, your spirit, your soul, everything. And when you get out, no matter how confident you were before, it is tough to pick yourself up. But the whole mentality in the prison, and I believe it's in most prisons, is to cut you down in size. Because when they see you comfortable, now I did a talk in Leeuwkop prison yesterday, and the guys there, the one guy was getting a bit full of himself, so they took his kettle away. I mean, that was like a hotel story for us.
He had a kettle in you.
Yeah, took his kettle away. And he said, I know, it's just because they didn't want me too comfortable. So in different levels, it's the same in every prison. But in a Zim prison where there is nothing. So I just want to give you a picture, Paul. There's no radio, no TV. There's nothing to give you an incentive to behave in prison. It's just the only entertainment is stories by hardcore armed robbers, hour after hour, how to break into different cars, how to break into houses, what gangs to join, where to buy guns, where to sell merchandise. It just goes on and on and on. And there's a lot of innocent people in there. And these are their heroes.
So it becomes like a university.
They call it the college. Yeah, so, and the beatings are horrific in prison in some.
Yeah, I want you to talk about that, because that is serious human rights abuse. The way you describe the beatings, I mean, it's like torture.
And the guards put you in handcuffs and leg irons, so they handcuff you behind your back, put you in leg irons, and lie you on your stomach, and you have your feet in the air. So the soles of your feet are facing up, and they beat you under the soles of your feet. And sometimes it depends on the offenses. So if there's stabbings and stuff like that, you can get 100 beatings under each foot. And that's with a 1 meter long rubber baton. I promise you just one. It is unbelievably painful. And you know, I saw guys with broken legs, broken heel bones, broken feet. The beating, and some guys would fear, because it's like 40 officers attacking from everywhere, all wanting to, you know, it's like a pack of hyenas.
Yeah, and this was the interesting thing, all the officers wanting their turn with the baton. I mean, it sounds like a kind of gathering of psychopaths.
Yeah, Bullet, I think it was, you know, when you look at it, I often prayed about it. You know, I just thought, God help these guys, because there's something wrong with them. You know, it was just an outlet. I mean, everyone was suffering in the whole country. It was during the Zimbabwe dollar crash. So there was no food outside of prison, on the shelves, anywhere. So everyone was upset, you know. There was anger. But don't take it out on a prisoner. They're prisoners, you know, and they're rough and wild.
But that's the nature of institutions, whether they're the police forces or the army or schools. It's give the weak man a uniform and a baton and a gun.
Yeah.
And you're going to unleash the dogs of hell.
Yeah. You know? No, absolutely. It's someone that gives them authority over someone that they normally wouldn't have. Yeah, love it.
I know your dad, you talk in the book about how your dad meted out a few serious thrashings.
Yeah.
Do you think that and boarding school kind of had an effect on your psyche? That either were you able to deal with prison conditions better? Do you think maybe it set you up to go down that path where you're quite aggressive and
Paul, I think the boarding school had a hell of a lot bigger effect on me than my father. So I think I probably got maximum a dozen beatings from my dad, but they were severe. I mean, I would mess myself every time he took on it. But from about the age of 10, I don't recall being beaten by him.
Maybe because by then you could probably beat him back.
No. He was a big man. Eh? And he was a wonderful man. I mean, I loved him to bits. Eh? But he just said that when you're wrong and I was naughty, I got badly beaten. I mean, you know, I wouldn't do that to my children ever. But I think the resilience you build up. Now, I believe, Paul, that people say, you know, I don't know anyone that could have gone through what you went through. But I believe you can build resilience. I don't think you're born with it. And I think going to boarding school at 6 years old and all the way through my life, and then from 12, you know, I lost my dad when I was 12, so that's very traumatic. Then from 12 all the way through school, my teenage years, I had the Rhodesian Bush War. And that was a wild environment there. I mean, the war creates wildness. I mean, the barroom brawls and that I was exposed to, not always involved in. Obviously, when I was young, you can't. But you become wild.
It's quite a weird thing, you know, because I know, you know, it was an internal war. So the guys were fighting in the bush, in the Shatin, I think they called it.
Yeah.
And then coming back to town on pass and just venting all that combat stress, that PTSD, that fatigue, that anger in barroom brawls.
And 90% of those guys were under 25. Eh?
That's unbelievable.
Kids, unreal.
I know, before, I mean, no one should be going. I believe the human brain only really is only mature by 25. So anyone under the age of 25 is utterly malleable. Their brains aren't fully formed.
Yeah.
That's what I've heard from other combat veterans.
Okay.
And so you had this war going on.
Yeah.
Which I think did a serious amount of damage to the country's soul.
Absolutely. And then, I was always a very passionate rugby player. And rugby is a game by gentlemen, but it's wild. So, you know, the rough side comes out in that. So I think, you know, from boarding school, the war, playing rugby and water polo, which is also rough, it set me up. And also, I loved the bush. So I loved the wildness of things and challenge. You know, and hunting is always thought of about killing and all that. It's not about killing. It's about conservation and the love of nature. I mean, if you want to know something about an animal, follow it and understand it and smell it and feel it, you know, not just take a picture of it.
Yeah. How did these ideas or these concepts help you in prison? Because as a guy who loved the bush,
yeah,
it must have been utterly devastating to be locked up and unable to even see it, to even smell it.
Yeah.
But yet you must have carried part of it with you inside.
You know, Paul, it's amazing because you self-counsel yourself on what to think in prison. So when I thought about the injustice, why me, what have I ever done to deserve all this? The pain was too much. So you block it out. You think about, I was engaged to be married. I think about someone else with my fiance. It was too painful, block that out. About my mates in the bush, enjoying fishing trips, everything. It all hurt inside. There's a correlation between your brain and your tummy, and you feel it in your stomach. So you don't think those things. You block them out completely. And I had this fantasy girlfriend named Cherie, and we'd fly all over the world in our private jet and catch mullet in Mexico. And I lived this beautiful world outside of that horror. And that's what made me happy. It was my way of getting over all that stuff. So, and then, you know, it's been proven that every time we think, see, and feel, our mind generates a signal that affects every cell in our body. And thinking is 98% of that signal. So what you think actually affects every cell in your body and brain.
Yeah, I can believe
that. And it's a powerful thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's a fantasy. It's a fact.
And you could use that fantasy and you could block out what was going on in the prison. I mean, you could sort of fly away, as they say.
And you know what was funny, Paul? So sometimes we'd wake up in the morning. Now, I'd share my fantasies with my prison mates. And then sometimes in the morning, they'd say, hey, Russ, how's it going? I said, no, look, how's Cherie? I said, hey, last night was cool, man. But you had to find these small bits of happiness in all that horror to keep sane. And you learn that life in prison or in Las Vegas is still just life. Yeah. It's what you make of it, no matter where you are.
You know, it's an incredible story of endurance, I think. And I wanted to talk about that because you endured. You did 10 years.
Yeah.
And I was really taken with the description of Phil, your fellow inmate, who was also banged up on a fit-up.
Yeah.
And he had that attitude that, and I've seen conscripts get.
Yeah.
This is nothing. You can beat me, you can insult me, you can degrade me.
Yeah.
This is nothing.
Yeah.
That must have taken enormous strength, inner strength, to be able to hold on to that belief and say that to a prison guard. Absolutely. What was it like?
Paul, he was a godsend for me. I mean, Phil was one of those old farmers. He's 11 years older than me. I was 42 when I went in, so he was 53. And I met him 1 year after my incarceration. I was at Commie. When I went to Chikarubi, I found him there. And when you're incarcerated with nobody from your culture, it's very, very difficult. I mean, you hear them all talking in their language about what they did when they were young and, you know, all different things, and you don't have that. You're just isolated. So when Phil arrived, he really, you know, when I was down, things are down, he was there for me and vice versa. But I promise you, when my fiance wrote and told me she's moving on after 4 years, I was completely finished. There was no food, there was no water, people were dying all around us. And I just given up. I lost 11 kgs in 5 weeks. And I saw Phil after 5 weeks in the hospital. And he said, Russ, you're going to be one of these guys dying all around us.
And they were really, literally dying around you in your cells.
Just unreal.
I mean, this is in the midst of a major cholera epidemic, and also you weren't getting any water. I believe the water was being carried into the jail.
Yeah, well,
in 25-liter containers.
In my first 6 years, Paul, so from I went in April 2003, until March 2009, I witnessed over 2,200 guys die. Just in where I was.
That's horrific.
It was unbelievable. When we were transferred to the medium security prison in Harare Central, out of 1,200 of us prisoners at Harare Central, 432 died in 8 months. That's more than one third of us.
So conditions were equally bad in Harare Central then?
No, they were worse. That was during the cholera outbreak.
Okay.
Yeah. But the thing is, Paul, there was no food outside of prison. You know, people were also dying out in the reservations. So it was a major.
It was like a perfect storm. You know, the prisoners didn't have a support network.
We got the last.
I mean, you guys were blessed, really, to have your sister especially. I know she was a trooper.
Yeah.
And a kind of supplier network to could bring you food because you weren't getting much in jail.
No. Well, I was 78 kgs in June 2006. I was heavy at school. And I remember that's when prison headquarters started allowing relatives to deliver food to their loved ones daily because guys were dying so badly. And my sister, both my sisters fed me for 3 months selling furniture and scraping money from wherever. And then Lynn sold her clay pot business and gave up her career just to feed me for 4 years. Now think about your sister doing that, Paul. That takes a very special person there.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't
for her. She hadn't done that.
She is amazing.
What was it like for them coming to the jail to visit you? They would have had an inkling of the conditions. They wouldn't have seen the beatings, obviously, but they must have known it was going on. How did they cope?
You know, Paul, I tried not to show them what was happening and what I was going through. But when I was released, they told me they knew everything. And to see them, you know, you get to know your sisters very well when you grow up with them. And you can tell when they're hurting. And they very, very seldom left the prison without tears. And that's painful, you know, when you're lying on that concrete floor in the prison, you think of all those things, you know. It's painful. But the thought of eating the food that my sister had just made was a huge booster, just that fact. And it's just a different world, Paul. You're isolated from everything. So if you get newspapers, they are cut to pieces. They go through all officers' hands first, so you get them 3 days later. All the books are so badly censored. I received a U magazine. There were 9 stories. 7 were cut out. And I complained. Officer said, if you don't like what I do, then don't bring your magazines here. And that was through the officer in charge.
So, but this was just basic sadism or cruelty. There was no reason to do this. It was just another way of trying to break you.
Yeah. Then, Paul, you talk about water. So in 2005, Harare City ran out of water. For 3 years, while in Chikiri Maximum Security Prison, each prisoner was allocated only 1 plastic cup of water a day. 1 cup of dirty orange city runoff water from a nearby dam carried by farm prisoners. That was to drink, clean your teeth, wash your face, bath, everything.
3 years.
For 3 years.
3 years.
Some guys didn't bath for 9 months. And the only time they bath is when it rained. And then run into the exercise yard and excitedly have a thorough scrub. And it was like Christmas.
Yeah, you have that sketch in your book.
Yeah.
It looks like, I mean, it looks quite innocent in a way. These guys all scrubbing up under the gutters.
Well, it was like Christmas. It was one of the highlights of our year.
I mean, that you remember it with such clarity.
Absolutely.
Says everything.
And we'd fight over the, you know, the broken gutters. And then we'd have big streams off the gutters. And we'd all take turns quickly. Okay, hurry up. Let me put soap. And then we'd jump in. I need the water. I need the water. So, yeah, you just said, found the humor and everything at all.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, humor must have been quite a tonic if you could access it, if you could find it there.
Yeah.
Did you? And how? And
I did, Paul. You know, there were some characters in there. I mean,
like Big Ass. I love the stories of Big Ass.
But you know who was the funniest? It was Munyaradzi.
Yeah.
At Kami. So he was just, when you looked at him, you started laughing because he was like a little comic. He was a tough, short little guy and big eyes, and he was just always had that face, that look where, and he's always laughing and joking and bouncing around. He's full of energy. And he would sing the guitar. We had a broken out old guitar with 3 strings. And he'd strum away on the thing and sing these country songs. And I'd have to pay him a cigarette or two to get him to sing, and he'd sing away and we'd laugh. And I remember I started exercising in there, and the first time I did, it was after about a week, and the prisoners all came and said, no, you can't exercise, the guards don't allow it. So I said, well, go and tell them I'm exercising. Next minute, five guards arrived. One of them was 3 stars, so it's like an officer. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm exercising, officer. He said, we don't allow that. I said, officer, just to release stress and, just to keep healthy. He said, we don't allow exercising. So I said, well, why don't you tell the officer in charge that? So they left, and that was the end of that.
But anyway, direct action.
Yeah, so Munya, now I started getting a lot of guys wanting to join me, because now the officers, they obviously saw the officer in charge, and he said, leave him alone. So I had a bit of a following. So I'd have 6-8 guys exercising with me. But Munya used to get jealous. So when I was exercising, he would take these rolled up blankets. We used to roll our blankets in a special way and tie them. It's a special way they do it, like a rolled beef, and pile them all in rows along the walls. And while I was doing push-ups, he would throw these things at me and then run out the door laughing out the cell. So I left one close to me, and he came closer, and then as he threw it, I grabbed one and threw it, and he was running past the toilet. Now, the toilet is a cement block in the corner of the toilet with a round stainless steel bowl. And I let rip and led him about 2 meters and hit him straight on the back of the head, and he went flying into the toilet. We laughed and laughed like crazy, but these are the funny things.
Just
that
small humor, and it must have meant so much.
Yeah, and what I loved about them, it was all everyday little things in life that you find humor in. You didn't have to have a big fancy joke or anything. You just laughed at the everyday little things.
Rusty, we're going to have to end it now. I just wanted to say thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Paul.
His book is Beating Chains. It's Victory Over Injustice. And this is Rusty Laboskakhni, hunter, conservationist, former prisoner, released prisoner. Last question.
Yeah.
You have no bitterness whatsoever.
Nothing.
That's amazing.
The biggest lesson I learned in prison was forgiveness, Paul. And we all have the ability to sever all anger, bitterness, revenge ties to the past. If you let it go, it's all behind you. You're only carrying it in your head. Leave it. Move forward. There's so much more in life to look forward to.
It's a good message and a very powerful one to end off on. Thank you very much, Rusty.
Thank you, Paul.
See you in the bush.
Okay. Bye.